This is Film Study with Ken McCusick. The second episode of the week for week 12 when we look at the offensive play. It was a 23-16 victory, so there was at least some offense. But Ken McCusick, how are you doing? You here to apologize for Flacco?
Life's good, Josh. How are you doing? I won't apologize for Flacco, not directly. We'll talk a little bit about it.
We've got to get a little bit into Flacco and what to take with this offense now that suddenly the Ravens are in the driver's seat for a playoff slot.
Yeah, they were last week as well. Baltimore fans didn't want to admit it to themselves. Now we can get a little bit closer to it, even though that Buffalo win was a setback for the Ravens this week.
Yeah, but you know what? The Ravens won two in a row, and we've gotta take what we can take. And no one thinks Buffalo's going to stick around.
That's true. That is true. No one thinks it, but it did really reduce the Ravens' chance to get in at 8-8, which was unfortunate. So did the Chargers win last week as well.
Well, hopefully we're not talking about an 8-8 team. Hopefully it's a much better season than 8-8. I'm tired of these 8-8, 500 seasons and not really knowing what to take from the season. Monday Night Football, though, it's a big stage. And this is the first time the Ravens have hosted a home Monday Night Football game in 5 years.
It's 2012 opener where they destroyed Cincinnati that year. But, yes, been a long time.
Right. So the Ravens, they came prepared to want to show off, want to get the attention of the national media in a time now where I think the NFL is just ratings and all are down on the NFL. The Ravens are trying to get some excitement going in the city of Baltimore for them. They came out with a brand new field. They redid the field, came out in their black jerseys. A lot of pregame excitement, and then the offense goes three and out before you can even. I missed the first drive because by the time I turned the TV on and got it to the right channel, it was over.
Yeah, unfortunately, there have been a few drives like that this year, so that was one of them.
Right. But we're going to talk about the offense, and we're going to talk about Joe Flacco struggling. But the offensive line had a great night.
They did. They had a very fine night. And some of the metrics we usually use, we'll go to those for starters. That they had ample time and space on 21 of 33 drop backs for Joe. They allowed one sack and one quarterback hit, but not a single pressure the entire night, which is very impressive. Joe had some ball-out quick situations where either through a screen pass or a swing pass, it was out quickly before pressure would have developed. But other than that, the line held up very well and gave him some nice long pockets to work with.
Yeah, and that's the problem, though, isn't it? Long pockets, no pressure, and he still struggled to find someone. But without talking to Joe right now, where was Jeremy Maclin on Monday night?
Yeah, I think he was. I think he made the team bus and all, but we didn't see him much. That's for sure.
I think there was one pass to him in the first quarter, and I believe then there were no attempts for the rest of the game.
Oh, wow. Now, I did not realize it was that bad. I'll have to bring it up, and we'll take a look at it.
I know it was that bad because I had a fantasy matchup, and for some reason, Macklin's on my team, and I was playing against my brother who had now I'm blanking. He had someone on the defense, not Suggs. He had C.J. Mosley on the defense.
Okay.
And C.J. Mosley scored way more points than Maclin, who never saw the ball. And that is not how it was projected to turn out.
I can imagine. So, yeah, five targets, one reception for Maclin for 6 yards.
And they were all in the first quarter. They had to be. Because I was getting irritated that I was not seeing Maclin on the screen. You know what? Five targets and only one reception, isn't that kind of the state of the Ravens' offense? And that's... That's kind of why Maclin disappeared. It's hard for Joe to trust these guys.
Well, I think trust is an issue. A lot of the times targets means Maclin was at the sideline or something and Joe threw the ball away. So you can't – not all these are on Maclin or anything. But,
okay.
It certainly it's not a good percentage of catches per target. And you'd like that number for a wide receiver to probably be north of 50%. But it's not, obviously, so it is what it is. What I will say is I saw an interesting thing out on Russell Street Report that was showing effectively maybe a second after the snap or something, the guy had taken pictures of the top view, which is the one from the sideline.
All right.
And it had, he made some interesting points, and I assume he went through and looked at all these, that the routes were extremely basic, just a bunch of 10-yard comeback routes and this and that. There's more to it than that in this game. The Ravens actually ran a lot of 1-2 and 3-man routes. It was really a throwback offense to about 2008. Joe's rookie year, they did a lot of what we would now call max protect or max plus protect, where they would have three men staying in. It would be a max plus, and a max would be two. You only have five eligible receivers, so when you hold them in, you know, it's a cost. Virtually never, except on a goal line situation, do you see everybody kept in except for one receiver. And the Ravens had that happen on one of the early plays of the game. It was a 24-yard pass to Wallace. They kept everybody in. They ran Wallace on one slant route, and he caught the ball and went 24 yards with it. So you can still have offensive success if you only have one guy in the route, but it has to be a carefully planned play.
I got you. The Ravens did attempt to open the ball up and throw the ball deep, and Joe was not able to connect with the guys. How concerning is that for a guy who's been known for years for that long ball?
Yeah, it was tough to see. I mean, you don't expect him to hit every single one, but you expect him to have enough opportunities, even in one game, that he can hit one. And he probably had two long balls in this game. The one down the middle to Wallace is the one that's really sticking out in my head now, that was wide enough open and really could have been caught. Should have been connected on, right. I should say. But yeah, it was another fairly difficult game. The ATS opportunity set, which we haven't done much with this year,
right,
said he should have had about 216 yards based on his 2010 through 2016 averages, and he actually had 133 net yards. So a bad game, a conservatively called game.
Right.
I think Joe was very upset with the way the game was called. But you know, they had enough time in this game, and they might not have anticipated it, but they did have enough time to have some of those great intermediate routes, but they didn't have a lot of them baked into the game plan. They didn't have a lot of intermediate throws that were even really attempted in this game.
Right. Joe is on pace for one of his career worst seasons, and that's frustrating. But we need to turn this, and we need to talk about some positive stuff, and that is the offensive line. John Gruden kept praising Clowney, and he's saying he's going to be the biggest paid guy in the NFL outside of a quarterback. Clowney, Clowney, Clowney. Clowney got some penetration early in the game, and then they seemed to quiet him down.
Yeah, they shut him right down. So he got a quarterback hit. Let me look at my chart here. Third play of the game, he got a quarterback hit. So that was right when you were turning the TV on, so you would have missed that one, Josh.
Yes.
And then
I saw that. I saw the defense come out. I missed that opening offensive drive.
Right, he's on the offensive drive that Clowney got the quarterback hit.
Oh, yeah, that would make sense. I missed that.
So the second drive, Flacco had to throw the ball quickly on 3rd and 18, and they weren't going to get the first down anyway, but he ended up throwing a 6-yard pass because Skuro was unable to pick up the stunt from Clowney.
And because it was 3rd and 18, so that's what Joe would do, is throw it 6 yards.
There you go. So the ball was out quickly anyway. I didn't charge Skura on that play, but it was another play where Clowney had would have impacted it if Joe had held the ball longer. And then the next drive, he ended that one also with a sack minus 8, where he stunted by Jensen, and it so happened that at the same time, Skura held his guy, Bernardrick McKinney, who would have also gotten to the quarterback just about the same time. So I left that sack charged evenly to both Jensen and Skura, but Skura actually got a higher charge because of the holding ball
penalty
on that play.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's the first three drives he's had a big play each time. The fourth drive, that's when the third drive, that last play was the one Ronnie Stanley was out. At that point, 7-0, Clowney's dominating the game. It certainly looks like the Ravens are in a hell of a lot of trouble because they hadn't come back from being down in a game the entire year. And then to begin quarter two, the third play on a 1st and 10 play, Clowney backed up Stanley, bowled him right back into the backfield and blew up a run for minus 2. Again, it looked terrible, but that was the end of Clowney's night on that particular play. He did not have a significant impact on any additional plays. And the Ravens offensive line took it from there. They scored on that drive, and they continued on to win the game. I wouldn't say handily, but They managed the game effectively so that the defense could more or less win it for them.
All right. All right. Well, I went over the Russell Street report today, and you've already got your offensive grades and everything up there. You titled it "Party Like It's 2008," which first reminded me that Joe Flacco was here in 2008. He's been this quarter as I don't. I think people have been calling and complaining about Joe Flacco in the talk radio since 2008. But I mean, for a guy who he's having a bad year. Personally, but we've got to give him a little bit of credit that he's stabilized a position that was not stable before him ever in Baltimore.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we almost had the old Browns jersey of all the quarterbacks since 1999 here in Baltimore, and there's some terrible players in there. Mallett and Case and Clausen and Schaub and Redman and
oh yeah, we don't complain. we totally complain every time we see Joe throw off that back foot. And it's irritating because we know it doesn't work for Joe. But then I think of Kyle Bowler, who would fall over that back foot.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly what he'd do.
So, we don't need to go down that dark path. Remember, he could throw the ball through the goalpost from his knees.
He saw that. He had no idea where a passing window was. Absolutely no clue. Plus, no idea where he held the ball in relation to his knee. He must have had five or six fumbles in his career where he kneed the ball out of his own hand.
Yes. Not very coordinated for a quarterback. but let's talk about this 2008 season because it was a successful season for the Ravens. They went 11-5.
Yeah, it was a hell of a special season. It was a great Ravens defense that year, not unlike this one. It was a very young Ravens team, and particularly on the offensive line. If you go across that line, a lot of people, don't remember exactly when Orr and Burke and players like that came together. So the 2008 season was kind of special in its own right. And I want to go from left to right here.
All right.
So Jared Gaither was in his second year, and Jared Gaither at that point still cared about football. And he played very, very well in 2008 and 2009. Then the Ravens decided they didn't want him to be the left tackle anymore. They moved over to right tackle, and he gave up probably on life, but he certainly gave up on being a left tackle for the Baltimore Ravens, and the Ravens had to get rid of him before any more damage was done. So anyway, Gaither was a terrific left tackle in 2008 and 2009. Left guard, they had Ben Grubbs, who'd just been drafted the year before. I remember being very upset about that pick because had they been one higher and the 49ers not traded in front of him, they could have gotten Joe Staley, which would have been also a great pick. But Grubbs was a fine player and did his job in Baltimore for the years he was here, left in free agency. The years he was here, he's a good guard and a really good pulling guard at that point. So at center, they had just moved Jason Brown there after Brown had been successful at guard before. And Jason Brown was a very big center, much in the mold of Jensen, in terms of being large enough physically to handle just about anybody that you could stack up at nose tackle against him. He played well in 2008, and he kept another good player off the field, which we'll get to in just a moment. At right guard, they had a right guard controversy, if you want to call it that, but Chris Chester had moved over from center. He's the guy that Brown bopped off the center job. And he took over at right guard. Well, the problem was the Ravens also had Marshall Yanda available. And somehow it took the Ravens 12 games to figure out that Marshall Yanda was really their guy. And then when they finally did, Marshall Yanda went off on the Steelers that year like it was nobody's business and looked really good. He hasn't stopped since, obviously, and he's headed for the Hall of Fame. Right tackle that year is the one that a lot of people forget. Willie Anderson came over from the Bengals for 1 year. Now, Willie Anderson was a three-time All-Pro who played 12 seasons with the Bengals, came over to the Ravens, bonded immediately with Ray Lewis as a leader of the offensive line. In a lot of ways, reminds you of Austin Howard a little bit today in terms of a veteran player coming to the team. Anderson had a fair amount more success, to be fair, but a good player, both of them very good players. And both of them very similar players because Anderson, at that point in his career, was a ponderous elephant of a player who used his arm length in pass protection as much as he could, but had quite slow feet, and they had to do certain things to cover him up and protect him. That's where we get. I'll take a breath. Any questions so far?
No, I'm following along. I'm assuming you're reading this and not bringing this all from memory because
this, I'm bringing it all from memory. Right. This is it's the story impressive. Of my life in a way. So, okay. So anyway, what I want to talk about next year. The Ravens employed a very different offense back then. They really, in Flacco's rookie year, wanted to actively take the ball out of his hand. They played all sorts of max protect. They did a lot of unbalanced line formations, which they did to cover up, I want to say Eric Williams, but that's not the guy, and Willie Anderson on the right side. Okay. So they would tuck him in the way they are tucking in Howard now when they move Stanley to the other side, or any time when both tackles play on the same side. It'll be Austin Howard on the inside and Stanley on the outside. So anyway, the offense played a lot more jumbo lines. They played a lot more unbalanced. The jumbo line that year, a lot of people remember, featured Haloti Ngata at the goal line frequently in a seven lineman formation that just no team found a way to stop effectively. And for 3 years, Ngata and that particular line formation had just their way with the rest of the NFL in terms of scoring and from the 3 yard line and in, pretty much.
Right. Those are some big guys.
There's some big guys. It was very fun to see Ngata on the other on the edge, along with somebody else on the edge that would be very effective. He's usually Ngata and Gaither were next to each other if they played it unbalanced. Right. So that was good. What else do we want to talk about? They had a fullback in that era, Lorenzo Neal, and he was a full-time fullback. The guy did nothing else. The only other thing he might have done, played at any point in the thing, was been a special team wedge player, but basically had no special teams responsibility either, because that's a very limited role.
Right, and you mentioned that as in that era, because fullbacks are rare now in the NFL, a full-time fullback especially.
That's right, and they were just starting to get rare then, so it was probably half the team still utilized two-back sets a lot of the time, and Lorenzo Neal was the last of a dying breed of great fullbacks, and he'd been to the Pro Bowl a number of times. The Ravens already had a fullback of their own in Le'Ron McClain, who they sometimes used in a two-back set as the fullback, but most of the time he was a tailback that year, and he actually led the Ravens in rushing yards with over 900. So, you know, that was a little similar to Ricard, who right now people are calling him this hybrid two-way player and whatnot, but he hasn't had a defensive snap now since week 6
right.
against the Bears.
They've settled him down on the offensive side.
Yeah, it sure does look that way. I'd like to see one of the things that stood out in practice this summer was that the defense always wears the white jerseys and the offense always wears the purple jerseys for practice so they can tell each other apart. Well, anyway, they put in Ricard at fullback, and all of a sudden, this guy with a white jersey is lead blocking against another guy with a white jersey, kind of thing.
Oh, like he wasn't switching jerseys between sides.
No, he wouldn't switch jerseys, but that'd be too much. But so they just brought him in to play fullback on these situations, and it looked really weird. But I would like to know now if he's at practice, if he's wearing a white or purple jersey at this point in the season. My guess is he's probably switched.
I would assume so. Yeah, based on how they're doing it on Sundays.
Yeah, look right. So what else was there about the 2018 that was interesting and similar? I think
checkdowns.
That's a good point. Joe has always had some checkdowns, but the one route that was Joe's bread and butter in 2008 was a 10-yard hitch route on the sideline. And he had unbelievable timing with Derek Mason on that. So he would be constantly going to the sideline, back shoulder. The ball was right there. Mason knew exactly when to cut. And they were just on the same page, and it was beautiful. It made Joe's rookie year much easier for him.
That's the key. This is Joe's rookie year. This is the year he wasn't supposed to start.
That's right. He wasn't even playing, but he developed that rapport quickly with Mason, and it's too bad that he hasn't found that rapport with another receiver this year. It could be Macklin, but because Macklin is the slot guy, he's not ideal. One of the outside guys, Perriman or Wallace, would be appropriate.
Right, we're starting to see it a little bit with Wallace.
Yeah, we know it wouldn't be Perriman, but we could see it with Wallace. But you know, Wallace, of course, you know, like anybody, wants a variety of routes, and probably wouldn't be entirely happy if he were a big hitch route guy. Whereas Mason was a pure possession receiver, not really a deep threat in the same sense that Wallace is.
Right.
So, okay, you're starting to see some of the similarities there. The other thing that Flacco had, and he still has now with Watson, is, and he had before for many years with Pitta, was a tight end that he liked to throw relatively short passes to over the middle, try and get them even with the linebackers and get a big play occasionally. And he's done that with Watson some this year. He's also thrown a whole lot of underneath passes to Watson that haven't gone anywhere. And Todd Heap was the guy back in 2008. And a lot of people remember Todd Heap's big catch of 2008 was the one that converted the 3rd and 2 after delay of game, probably should have been called, at the Tennessee divisional playoff game. And that, right, with the game tied at 10, the first down to Heap set him up in field goal range, or got him close enough that they could get in a field goal range with one more run from McGahee. So very interesting thing. And it really looks like they dummied down the offense largely for Clowney, but to handle the pass rush in general, perhaps, to make sure that Joe was going to feel less pressure in this game and would have more pocket time. And that part worked. But what didn't work is he wasn't then able to convert that into quality opportunities of medium distance, which are the ones that will really increase his yards per play.
Okay. Of course, that team, like we said, went 11-5. So I'm just going to go down here when we talk about the rest of the schedule later and put that you're predicting an 11-5 season from the Baltimore Ravens.
You know, this is the point where the 2008 team really turned it on. They had a nice I'm thinking about the wrong team. I think the 2009 team was really the one. The 2008 team was 2-3 after week 5 and came back to be 11-5. So they did go 9-2 down the stretch.
Okay. And we're going to talk about that stretch near the end of the show, because I want to talk about that stretch for the next five games. We're 6-5, so 5 more games left that we're going to talk about.
Right.
But it's nice to look at kind of a positive like that and look back and say, all right, well, for all the frustrations we've had this year, there's some similarities to a good team.
Yeah, to a good team. They have won with this formula before. That's what I'd say. They have won largely with this formula. I will say I don't think the offensive line currently is as good as the 2008 offensive line, but it's
right.
It's good enough, and they've made a lot, and it's well coached this time, in a way I really like. I'm happy about that. I think that, you know, the best thing you can say about it is, yes, they've won this way before.
Right. Of course, it's been 9 years. The NFL changes. The way the game is played always changes a little bit. Like we talked about the lack of a fullback. So it's interesting to see, well, is this way going to work again this year?
Yeah.
All right, let's get back to this year. Let's talk about this past game a little bit more, and let's go through this offensive line like we always do. Go through the scoring. Go through the guy who scared all of us early in the game when he went down for a little bit, Ronnie
right.
Stanley.
I get so upset about injuries when they happen on the field. There's a lot of profanity involved. There's a lot of, oh, my God. So anyway, Stanley went down. It looked like a very bad injury because he's holding his knee. As
right.
soon as I see that, you know, you get upset. And he left the field. He left the field very slowly, and he went to the clubhouse.
Right. Assumption was, well, hopefully we have him back for next week.
Yeah, that would have been, you know, I would have taken that certainly, regardless of what the results might have been in this game, had he not been there, and I don't think it would have been good. But amazingly, I didn't even notice he came out for the next drive, you know, but I did notice, of course, the Ravens are moving the ball, and then all of a sudden I saw the replay of the touchdown, which was run in by that scrum play. You know, the large rugby scrum where two or three of the Ravens' offensive linemen, including Stanley and Skura and Hurst, got behind and pushed it while Ricard was pulling it, and they managed to get Allen across the goal line as far as you know.
Right, yeah. Right.
So anyway, that drive, I finally noticed that Stanley was in the game when he's pushing the rugby scrum in. And you know, that was the big deal to me. It wasn't that they scored a touchdown. It's, oh, my God, Stanley's back in the game.
See, you saw that. Yeah. Stanley was back in the game. I'm pretty sure that everyone else on Twitter saw someone else in that scrum doing more offensive work than he's done all season. You know who that is. Rashard Perriman was right in there pushing along.
Oh, no, I missed that. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Perriman had finally had something to do to help the offense positively. He was in there pushing.
You go.
He almost made my top 3 for pushing that pile in, because I thought it'd be nice to Perriman.
Yeah, I was positive on just about everything, but then Jensen dove into that pile like it was a mosh pit at
Oh,
the
that
end
concerned me.
without actually having any ability to push the guy across the goal line.
Right.
He was just jumping on him for a touchdown celebration, effectively. And,
Well, and that's when it came to me, and that was when he saw that, I was sure a penalty was going to take the touchdown away or something with
oh, yeah, good
Jensen,
point.
because Jensen does stupid things like that where I feel like he can't control himself sometimes, where I
All right,
just want a little more discipline from Jensen. I love Jensen. A little bit, just a little bit more brains.
we'll come back to him in a minute because I got a point to make on that as well. But let's talk about Stanley for a
Yes.
second. So he got a lot of clowny in this game, and he allowed a shared quarterback hit to Clowny, and then he got
From
allowed
Clowney.
Clowny to from Clowny. Yeah,
From
yeah.
Clowney.
From
Flacco did not
allowed.
hit him, right?
No, Stanley allowed it to Clowney is what I'm
Okay,
saying.
so he got
Allowed the
that
quarterback.
allowed him to get the quarterback hit. Gotcha.
That's right. So he actually had a swim move. He swam over Stanley, then he swam over Hurst with the other arm. It was pretty impressive, beating of a double team. But anyway, it was one of those plays. And then he also Clowney backed up Stanley once to blow up a play for a loss of two. So that costs Stanley points as well. But from that point forward, Stanley had 41 plays after that penetration event, and he only missed three blocks after that. So he went 38 of 41. A lot of that was against Clowney. He was very effective. It worked out that Stanley did not allow a single pressure. Nobody did for the game. And 0.86 per play was his score. When I adjust up, I gave him the full maximum adjustment possible. And that works out to be 0.96 and an A for Stanley. So Stanley's second best game of the year. The only other game he had that was as good was Oakland.
That's awesome. James Hurst, I believe he got a flag really early in the game. He was holding, if I'm
Yeah, he had a
correct.
holding call in level two. When was that? It was in the third quarter.
Okay, then I'm thinking of
Yeah.
someone else early in the game. All right,
Yeah, it
well,
would have been
James.
Skura.
Oh, yeah, Skura when he was holding Clowney. That's what I'm thinking of.
Okay, so Hurst had this holding call in level two, really ticky-tack hold it. I looked at it about three times, and I thought first, because Williams had moved up into Hurst's spot, that Williams might have been the one called for a hold, and the official just missed the number because they expected Hurst to be at that left guard spot. But I think they did actually call it in level two. It was a very trivial call. He basically hit a small man in the shoulder, might have gotten a tiny pinch of jewelry, and the guy spun of not jewelry. We've had too much of that lately. Of jersey, and he spun him to the ground and got the flag. So other than that, though, Hurst had a great game because he did not allow any. I'm sorry. He did have one half of a QH and one half of a penetration otherwise. But scored very well, a B after adjustment, and a very nice positive game from James on his return. He had 6 of 7 pulls made, so he's now up to 34 of 41 in that category, something he's really excelled at this year as a guard, and really tells me that his agent should be looking for a spot for him as a guard and not a tackle next year.
Okay. All right, Jensen, the brains of the line. Let's get to him.
You know, I'm sure Ryan is a fairly smart guy. I've heard him speak, and he really sounds it. I know
I'm sure he just gets a little excited. I like that. I like the energy that he plays with. I like that when Flacco got hit, he comes in and defends his quarterback. I like all that. Just the penalties concern me.
Okay, well, the diving definitely concerned me, but I'll tell you what, the penalties have actually been very good since week one when he was flagged three times for holding in week one. Despite all of the immense extracurricular activity he's been a part of and instigated,
Right.
he has not been flagged since. Not for any penalty, not
Okay.
for a false start, not anything.
All right, then
So
keep it up, Jensen. I'm scared, but you obviously know where the line is.
he does, and you know what he does really well? He keeps his hands at his side after the play is over and the shoving has started. So he'll go ahead and he'll continue to block. And then when the other guy starts to get pissed off and either throws punches like Edwards at Oakland did,
Yeah.
or swings back at him in some sort of sissy open-handed slap deal or whatever, it starts happening. Then he puts his hands in his side, and it's like, what's going on
So
here?
he tries to draw the penalty.
Yeah, that's right. That's he's very good at knowing how to do that. So
All right.
I'm very impressed. Heard good things. Seen good things from him, I should say.
All
So,
right, but
but in this
he
game.
struggled.
He struggled a little bit, and of the linemen, he probably had the least impressive game, but he was still solid enough. And you know, in anybody else's system, a C minus is a really terrible grade. In my system, a C minus is okay. You want to avoid fall off the table games. You want to avoid games where you're terrible. But he had a C minus game, and they focused some activity from both Clowney and McKinney through the middle that was a little harder for him to handle, and that resulted in one half a sack and a couple of penetrations for losses on run plays. He actually gave up 2.5 of those. So the center scoring is fairly unforgiving. He got a C minus. You know, it's not something that worries me at this point. And hopefully, he got his elbow a little dinged up, it looks like, on one of the last plays of the game. And hopefully, there's nothing serious there. But he did look like he was in some pain, writhing around on the ground near the end of the game. So we'll see where that goes.
So if a C minus does not worry you, I wish that was the same for my parents when I was in high school, because
Well,
I could handle that C minus. That worked out pretty well.
I wish I could say that my average was a C minus in high school,
Right.
but it wasn't.
All right, let's get to Skura. We talked about the early holding penalty.
Yeah, so he had that early holding penalty, but he had a clean sheet otherwise. Four missed blocks, no other negative events. He's done a lot of positive things. He had three blocks in level two in this game. He had a pancake. He converted his only pull, and the pull and the pancake and one of his three highlights all came on the same play, and it was a beauty. You go to Q2, 4:22 to go. Watch him pull to the left. He avoided a lot of traffic in the backfield. You and I talk about that from time to time, about how if the other team gets penetration, they can screw up your pulls. Well, they had it on this play, but he was able to negotiate his way around it, get into level two, and hit Clowney right in the knees. So that was a very good job there. Took Clowney right down, and that was a run that went for no gain, but still a beautiful block.
Right. What you haven't mentioned as we've been going through this line is that all of these guys played every offensive play,
Well,
except for
with
the one with Ronnie Stanley when he went hurt and Bowanka came in for one.
yeah, so Bowanko came in at left guard, and they moved Hurst over to left tackle
Right.
for one
So
play. That's right.
62 plays in the game, and they were out there the entire time. It's very impressive.
Yeah, that's normal.
Is
Your
that
offensive
normal with
lineman
them?
should play every
Okay.
play, and then you may have a few extra plays from somebody else who's in as a sixth lineman, say. But it just doesn't always work out that way.
All
They,
right.
uh, you know, you hope it can. Your really great offensive lineman, or the regular offensive lineman, some of them play every snap an entire season, and
Okay.
that's certainly been the case with Joe Thomas, who'd played over 10,000 consecutive snaps without ever leaving the field.
Okay. All right. Well, that stood out to me, but that's just commonplace, I guess. All right. Let's get to Austin Howard.
So I'm going to say Skura got a B for the game.
Okay.
Really, he's had a very underrated and I think undervalued consistency component that's not getting captured by the PFF grading. And I just want to point that out. I mean, I don't think PFF could have possibly charged him with any pass rush events in this game because he didn't have any, and we're both cooking with water. So, you know, we're watching the same film. So
Right.
he did get, we would have gotten charged for the holding call, maybe for being pushed back a couple times into the pocket, but he's making his blocks. Even if he's not driving anybody, that still can often be the case where he's holding the somebody else's combination block at the line of scrimmage, or he's the one moving to level two and making the combination block. And so I'm impressed with his play, and I think it's probably being undervalued currently by PFF, who's the other major grading outlet for offensive line play.
All right. Well, let's get to Howard, who was the star of that line on Monday night.
Yeah, Howard, a great game. So he's been a little bit up and down this season. We know about this. The good thing about Howard is he's never fallen off the table in any particular game. He's never had a Cousins game or you know, some of the games that Hurst had when he was a
Right.
tackle. But he's been at least in the 50s. I think about 54 has been his lowest for any game, and 60 is passing at tackle. So he's been good enough to get the Ravens by. But this game, A plus. He only had one negative event of any sort, and it came in the third quarter when he got pushed back and shed by number 93. That's Heath. And as the only negative event, he had one other missed block, and he scored a 96 in terms of raw score, sorry, 94 in terms of raw score, that would have been up to something like 102 if I had given him the full credit for his extra credit points for being against Clowney and level of competition and whatnot. But I never go above 100, so he gets an A plus. That's the highest you can go. Great game. We would have really loved to have him on the show as a guest tonight. I'll just say that, hoping he's listening. But it didn't work out for whatever reason. And we make the invitation again at a future date.
All right. Yeah, I mean, and that's something that you look at and like, how can he even build on that when you have such a good game? But if he can just continue to play at that level, that's exciting.
Oh, it'd be unbelievable if he could continue to play at that level. I mean, I'd love him to play at a B minus level the rest of the year, frankly. And the other thing I'd really like to know is how much he's been affected by all the rotational play at right guard. And they finally got a guy in there now who's been in there for several games, Skura. He missed a couple, but he's
Right.
basically been the guy for about 6, 7 weeks now. And is that really helping him at this point? Have they built up a rapport that they know what each other's doing and what to look for and how to handle a stun handoff, which would be one of the big things they need to do together? So I would have loved to kind of
Right.
chew the
You
fat on that with
yeah,
him.
you want to talk to him and see how he developed and what got him to this A plus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, is it something? I mean, these guys are both playing very well right now. Could it be something that would continue?
All right, well, I think you've hinted at your defensive MVP or offensive MVP, so let's get down to the offensive MVP.
Okay, so I'll give you want to go first with your number three?
Sure. My number three is Chris Moore for his catch from Sam Cook to kind of added that excitement and woke up the offense.
Yeah, a very important play in the game. Moore had a couple other catches. Neither of them that was for a first down, but both of them were important in terms of getting the Ravens close to a first
And
down.
the key being that when we got guys who are struggling to catch the ball, Moore is catching the ball, and I'd like to see him get more chances on the offense. He's been very good on special teams. I'd like to see him get more of a shot on the offensive.
It's a reasonable thing that he might, and we'll see where they go with that. My number three guy, Sam Cook. So I'm giving it to him really for his punting primarily, although that play was huge, his one pass play.
Especially
Going
since
across the.
he did throw that into some coverage.
Yeah, he threw it to a spot. So
Right. He
the
lofted
guy
it.
who. Yes, and the defensive back there, the actually. The guy who's trying to stop the gunner, who's become a defensive back at that point,
Right.
had no idea that the ball was being passed.
Okay.
So he threw it to a spot, and Moore went to the spot and got it, and that was it was very well
Okay.
done.
So that's
Yeah.
why they lofted it, because he knows where
Yeah.
exactly where he's going to throw it, and then it's up to Moore to get to that spot at the right time.
That's right. And as the guy who's blocking the gunner, you really need to watch the gunner's legs and feet, and then try and stay in front of him and try and block him towards the sideline and do some things. And Moore had to actually release like a receiver to get by him, but he would do that as a gunner
Right.
anyway. And then he ran to the spot while the other
All
guy
right,
chased him down.
but you've got him here for his punting because
I've
he's
got
had
it.
a great season.
Yeah, he really has. I mean, he's redefined punting to the point where other teams need to put two guys back a lot of the time to defend the entire field against where he can put the ball. So he's had one bad punt, but his ability to just kick a line drive when that's what it takes. He kicked what effectively we would have called in the 1970s a coffin corner kick that didn't, I think it went out of bounds at about the 5-yard line, but it not only dropped at about the 20, it got all kinds of roll afterwards. And
Right.
he's controlling that, by the way. That's not by accident. Cook can kick the ball two different ways or maybe six different ways, but
On how
he's
he's
certain,
on the spin
yeah.
he's putting on it.
That's right. So he can put backspin on the ball that makes it stop at the 1-yard line, or he can kick it so it follows through and rolls like a baseball would for more
Right.
yardage.
Meanwhile, if I go out and try to punt the ball, I'm lucky if it goes straight.
Yeah, there you go.
All right,
Your number two
my
guy.
number two is Joe Flacco. He had trouble throwing the ball, but he had a good run to seal the game. And it was nice to see that movement from Joe Flacco, a guy who seemed like he's been a little stiff this season. He still does not know how to slide, and that's irritating as a baseball fan, but it worked in this game.
Yeah, they made that point some various places that you slide with your left leg, and he always seems to slide with his, on one knee, basically, not on his hip.
Yeah, he
Is
slides. He does not slide
that
on his hip. He slides.
what
He drives that knee into the ground and destroys his knee brace every time.
That's right. So
He doesn't go back. You go back on a slide, and he does not do it. And I don't understand why he does not know how to slide.
Yeah. And he played. Yeah, that's right. They pointed out that he played baseball, didn't they, on the broadcast?
Oh, I don't know about that. I just know he can't slide. All right, who's
okay,
your number two?
My number two guy, Ronnie Stanley. Terrific game. A big part of the Jadeveon Clowney shutdown, and coming at a great time. Let's hope Stanley puts in the same kind of finishing kick this year that he had last year, because that would really be something. That'd make the Ravens an exciting playoff team if he could do that.
All right. My number one is Alex Collins. I don't think we've had him as a MVP this season. He's really, they keep putting more and more work on him, and he's holding on to the ball. The fumbles have gone away, and especially that rugby scrum, to hold on to that and push through that was exciting.
Yeah, I think that was Allen, but that's okay.
Oh, that was Allen. Why did I have it marked as Collins?
No, no problem. Well, Collins
of course
had
it's Allen.
60
it was
yards
line.
And 16 carries. Yeah.
Right.
60 yards on 16 carries for Allen. He had the one really long run. He also had a TD run of his own from 8 yards where he was barely touched. Very impressive game for him, and I can see that pick. My number one guy is Howard. I just think the offensive line won them this game. It was really won at tackle on both sides. Howard had the slightly better game. I could have put Howard slash Stanley 1-2, but that would have been almost a disservice to Howard in terms of how good his game was. So I go with Howard, Stanley, Cook, or my three.
See, I've been mixing up players again tonight, which means we're gonna get those. I'm gonna get those iTunes reviews again, saying Josh needs to pay more attention.
What happened? I'm sorry. You're talking about Allen and Collins. That's
right.
Really
I got
fine.
Those guys mixed up, so it's all right. I can take it. Let's get to the feedback time of the show. Let's get to the film study mailbag. This is where you go on Twitter and you can send. Tweet at Film Study Ravens, but really you want to do the hashtag Film Study Mailbag, and that's when we can find your questions and address them on each episode. So a few questions in today. The first one I've got up here is from Chelsea Hulbert, who says, what, if any, was the strategy behind the play calling on the three and out offensive series that got booed during the game? Because it feels like there's so many passes behind the line of scrimmage. Is that part of the Ravens' strategy?
Okay, so I'm trying to think of which three and out she means here. So there was one in the third quarter, and there was the first of the game. Now let's assume it was the first of the game.
Right.
I think there were multiple frustrations that caused the booing. First of all, they had an 8-yard play on first down. That was a catch by Moore that set him up. So once you're in second and two, the crowd has a different level of expectation. They're in the game at that point as much as they'll be for the offense in a 0-0 game. And they expected more, but we had incomplete pass. Where Jensen gave some ground, the pocket was compromised, Joe didn't have an ample time space opportunity, but it was an incomplete pass. And then they threw another incomplete pass when Clowney made really his one of his best players night, a swim move to beat a double team from Hurst and Stanley to deliver a quarterback hit that didn't give Joe much of a chance there either. But being second and two, I think that's the problem from the fans' perspective and why it was booed. As far as what's the offensive philosophy, I don't really think it's any different. I think in this case it was more a case of Clowney was just beating the Ravens pretty badly.
Right, and I think that fan frustration is coming from, it seems like there's a lot of, we need 3 and 6 and we throw it 3 yards. We throw it 4 yards. And that's not a strategy. That's the other guys aren't open. Maybe you can break it for a couple yards here, right?
That's right. And I think you need to look at risk and reward in this case. And Joe Flacco, one thing he did very well in this game was manage risk and reward. They had no turnovers. The Ravens got 3 turnovers. If Flacco, were Brett Favre, he might have thrown 2 interceptions in this game. But trying to force the ball into a window, trying to make something happen when it didn't need to happen. And Joe said after the game, look, if this is the way we want to win games, I'm on board. I can do it.
Right.
But I think we're going to get into the playoffs and we're going to need to suddenly turn it on in terms of the offense. And I'm paraphrasing this, of course.
Yeah.
But I think he's frustrated with the offense, but he says, it's his job to win whatever the deal is. And I hope that he'll be able to continue to do that, whatever it'll take,
Right.
To get them to the playoffs.
Sure. So Joe wants a more exciting offense, and that brings us to at Keep It Up Man, who asks, why hasn't the offense used Joe more in a play-action passing where he rolls out of the pocket and throws deep? He's great at that.
Yeah, that used to be a very successful play. Now, we call that zone block left, naked boot right is the one that they use most frequently. And the reason is they want to boot Flacco to the right because right-handed quarterbacks have much more success planting their feet in that direction. Joe Flacco is actually running the wrong way for where he needs to throw when he boots to the left. So in order for that play to work, that zone block to the left has to have a two-back set. So you're using two of your offensive players, your eligible receivers right there. You need to completely fool the edge defender. It depends on fooling one particular guy who's on the backside. He needs to be fooled for that play to work. They did get him fooled once in this game. They still didn't get a good pass off, which was unfortunate. And then another time, they booted him to the left, which is the very unusual way. Probably only 1 in 10 of them now that they do this way. Joe did get his feet set that time, and I thought he had a short completion on that one. Might have been as much as 9 or 10 yards. So I'd have to look again, but it might have been a throw to Max Williams that I'm thinking of earlier in the game. But anyway, yes, I like the play. I like the boot. I just think that most of the other teams in the NFL, because the Ravens have been running that for all Flacco's 10 years, now are really aware of it, and they look for it on tape, and they look for it in the game. But great question.
Okay. Rob McDonald asks, during the Monday Night Football, Gruden said the Ravens ran a Spider 2 wide banana. What the heck is that? And I think someone just bet Gruden, I bet you can't say Spider 2 banana. Or whatever it is, Spider 2 wide banana, and he fitted into the broadcast. What is this play?
I think it really is a play that he recognizes from his own playbook, and his own terminology for it was Spider 2 wide banana. And that's fine. It does not serve the public interest for Gruden to talk about that, but Gruden wanted to say, well, I know what that play is. It's Spider 2 wide banana.
Right. And well, all it made me want to do is, all right, what if this play looks like a spider? What if this play looks like a banana? All right, did the guy run in the shape of a banana? What's going on here that you would call this thing Spider 2 wide banana?
Yeah, this it'd be an interesting question sometime. Ask Gruden if you find him. But I don't know if you remember the Super Bowl IV video is legendary for Hank Stram on the field having two things that he says. One of them is, come on, let's keep matriculating the ball down the field. You know, matriculate and roll in school. You know, it's right. Matriculate the ball down the field. It means something different. And the other one was 65 toss power trap. And that was a play. And they kept going back and he would keep saying this. And if you go to the stadium in Kansas City, they've actually got a plaque outside where Hank Stram's statue. And at the bottom of it is just the quotation, 65 toss power trap.
You know, so, anyway, that's not a you're getting me thinking now. I think I'm going to come up with some T-shirts that say Spider 2 Wide Banana. I think those would be some popular shirts.
You know, it's worth the thing, but all my money is tied up in other investments right now, Josh. I won't be able to contribute.
Come on, it's going to have a spider on it, a banana on it, and then the little football play sketch. I got to figure out what Spider 2 Wide Banana is, but I think it'll work out and sell well. All right, I love Minion Hunter. He sends questions in every week. This week he sent the world's longest question to ask, are the Ravens the type of team that gels late in the season?
There are elements of this that certainly look like it. And the offensive line play last night is a big one. You know, being able to come together and figure out how to stop one other team's asset. So Clowney was stopped. They did something on Clowney that you never see. You hear it talked about by people who don't really understand how blocking works. They'll talk about, well, you don't need to just double team him. You need to triple team him. And people will say that. And you can't triple team someone in the NFL. It's hard to get three bodies around one body.
Right. It's hard to double team without someone getting open.
It is. It's hard to double team. And you know, that you find ways to chip and try and correct the guy in a position or whatnot. But it's very hard to double team. Well, anyway, two separate instances in this game, there actually were three guys on Clowney blocking him. Which is just, it's absurd, but they figured out he's the guy they need to stop in order to win this game. They did it, and they successfully were able to grind this one out, including a big contribution from the defense, of course.
All right, well, the Ravens yelling, let's talk about the rest of the season, because this Monday night is Steelers.
Hey, Josh, I'm sorry. Before you go on, I've got two other questions I've got to add.
I missed some questions then.
Yeah, you didn't miss them. I just didn't get them into the mailbag thing, and I apologize for that. But first one is at Mario Kane 4, and he says is, thank you. His question is on the topic of the Ravens making the playoffs, and do we have what it takes to win a second-round game? And in particular, do we have the offense necessary to win a second-round game? So that's good. First of all, Marco, appreciate you already giving the Ravens their first-round game and the wild card. And
that's right.
Good. Or maybe he thinks they're going to win the division to start with. That would be good, too. But anyway, it'd be great if the Ravens could get to that divisional round. And do they have that? They will have to go on the road to either Pittsburgh or New England and beat either of those teams they have here. My history, answer is yes.
Well, that's history. History says you don't count out Joe Flacco and John Harbaugh in the playoffs, no matter what.
And you really don't count out the Ravens defense on the road in the playoffs ever. Right. So this is a very talented defensive team, and nothing this team would do would really shock me in terms of how far they would go this year. Right now, the DeVoa says they're the second best team in the AFC. They have the best special teams, they have the best defense, and they have the 26th best offense in the National Football League. Obviously, the easy place to improve among those three categories is going to be to the 26th offense.
Right.
So hopefully they'll be able to find some way to develop an offensive identity, probably by having this offensive line gel and stay together that will work.
All right.
I've got one other question here I need to find, because this fan got it in. I don't want to miss it. It is Stacy, who said, and she is at SoulSista49, says, I read a post that said Ravens can't make a wide receiver elite because of the type of offense we have. Perriman is proof. So,
no.
I don't buy that. You don't buy that, and that's fair enough. I do think the Ravens, and to Stacy's point here, need to develop the proper coaching methods to improve receiving skills of their players. And we talked a little bit about this when we were talking about DeAndre Hopkins, but this is something that is missing, generally speaking, from Perriman, is receiving skills.
Right.
It's not physical skills. He needs to figure out how to not be distracted, how to get out of breaks, how to work through contact, how to get off the line of scrimmage at all. I mean, there's so many things wrong with Perriman's receiving skills. And things that he made up for by being a bigger, stronger, faster guy at every level coming up to this.
Yeah,
I
was just going to say, you go back and listen to the previous episode where we went through the defense, but where we compared Perriman to Hopkins.
Right. Well, Stacey, we really do appreciate the question, and hope you'll jump in again.
And I would use Torrey Smith as an example of the Ravens can build a wide receiver, because I don't think he's really put up the type of numbers and play that he, since he's left Baltimore.
Yeah, he did work very well with Flacco. Torrey had more receiving talent than Perriman, but yeah, he hasn't done as much since he left Baltimore.
Right. Let's talk about the future, because Monday Night Football this coming week is Steelers Bengals, and a couple of weeks ago I thought it would be obvious who to root for. It's not so obvious to me right now. As the Ravens are 6-5, the Bengals are 5-6, Steelers are on top of the division at 9-2. And the people talk like I heard a lot of talk about the Steelers having the easy schedule, but I think they have the hardest schedule out of these three teams.
Okay, well, they still play the Patriots, right?
So the Ravens, let's just look at 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So the Ravens have Lions, Steelers, Browns. The Bengals, the Bengals have the Steelers, the Bears, the Vikings, and then the Steelers have the Bengals, the Ravens, the Patriots. Those could be some tough games. Two division games, and then the Patriots.
That's right. And then they have the Texans and Browns to finish it off. They're
right
at Houston. Maybe Houston can do us a favor. I doubt it. They play at home against the Browns. I think I'd pretty much rule that one out as a potential win. Just if nothing, because Cleveland's not giving up the number one draft pick at that point.
Right. No, and right. If you want to be positive, the best case scenario, the Steelers lose to the Bengals, Ravens, and Patriots, and we're looking
right
at an 11-5 team.
That's right. So we should know very quickly whether or not there's a chance for the Ravens to win this. In fact, I'd be shocked if we don't know by the end of the December 10th game where the Ravens play at Pittsburgh. Because it will certainly, the Ravens will either lose a game or they'll gain a game on that day unless there's a tie. But if the tie, they'll effectively lose an opportunity to gain a game, and it will be done. But if they win that game, yeah, they're still in the division hunt. And a win at Pittsburgh in that game will virtually guarantee the wild card spot, because that's the most likely loss that the Chargers are depending on among two that they need. Okay.
So for this coming week, though, we want to root for the Bengals to beat the Steelers, right? Even though we're in a wild card battle with the Bengals.
That's right. I do like the idea of the Bengals beating the Steelers for a lot of reasons. This is obviously the game's being played at Cincinnati. So in terms of the portent or the what this really means for the rest of the season, I don't think it means that much if the Bengals beat the Steelers at home. The Steelers have already been beaten by some pretty mediocre teams this year. They got beat by the Bears anyway. Yeah, same as the Ravens. Jacksonville is each of us lost to Jacksonville. Right. That was a good team in both cases,
but the Steelers struggled against the Packers this past week.
They did. They struggled against
the
Packers.
They beat them, but they struggled.
And they beat the Chiefs, too, 19-13. And that win ain't looking too good right now.
Right. To think positive that the Ravens even have a shot at the division, they'd have to win out. They'd have to win the next five games.
That's right.
So you're still probably looking at a wild card slot for the Ravens. But at least for one more week, we can cheer against the Steelers.
Yeah, I mean, that's another way to say it. If the Ravens did win all five of these games, the key game then is that the Steelers have to lose a game to the Bengals or the Browns. So
right, and it's not going to be the Browns.
Yeah, and they play the Patriots at home, so it's probably not going to be the Patriots either, honestly.
Right, but they probably have the division.
Yeah.
But it's not counted out yet.
Yep, I'd agree.
All right, Ken. Again, it was great to go through this offense with you like we normally do. We talked about your article on Russell Street Report, talking about comparing the 2008 Ravens, Joe Flacco's rookie year, and that offense. Tell people where they can find you on Twitter.
So they can go out to Russell Street Report for the article, got time references, use your game pass with it. There's all kinds of time references in this one that are specific to pass rush events or really nice highlight blocks. Find me on Twitter at Film Study Ravens, and we have an active discussion all day. Since I'm retired, I have my tweet deck up all day, and I'm enjoying that, responding when questions come in, loving your mailbag questions, and don't be afraid to reach out. Josh, your show, tell them about that.
My show is Section 336. I'd really appreciate it if you would go on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use on your phone and just hit subscribe to that, just like you do to Film Study Mailbag, Film Study with Ken McCusick. Do the same exact thing. We talk Baltimore sports, a lot of Orioles, but we get into the Ravens as well, and in a more laid-back fan, like a bunch of guys sitting at a bar.
All right.
So, all right, Ken, have a great weekend, and we will speak next week after hopefully the Ravens win their third in a row.
Yep. We'll talk to you Monday, Josh.
All right. Bye.